I've been in philosophy for 25 years now, so getting on a bit and approaching my sixth decade. So it's a point in life where I think it's good to just take a pause, make sure I've been on the right track so far, because it's soon going to be too late to change my mind about anything. So I think it's a good time to just reflect. So I've been in my career sort of working on causal powers, generally quite interested in causal realism. But there are always doubts, and of course philosophy, doubt is crucial to do philosophy well. One mustn't just start taking things for granted. And some of these doubts are not easy to dispel. So I decided it was now or never. I had to take some time out and sit back and really think about some of my fundamental assumptions. To do this, I travelled to the Arctic Circle, where I've got a very good friend who's built a cabin on the side of the fjord. And in the cabin, there is a bed, a stove, which is very important, and a writing desk. And I asked if he would allow me to stay in this cabin for 6 days and nights, undisturbed, so that I could do all my thinking. And he just left me with some bread and a block of cheese. And have you heard of a Osterhøvel? It's a Norwegian invention. It's a scraper that you scrape along the top of the cheese, and it gives you very, very thin slices. Norway was historically a very poor country until they discovered the oil. So they needed this scraper so they could have the smallest possible portion of cheese. So I was there with the block of cheese, bread, undisturbed. And let me tell you what I was thinking about. So it seems we can, in some way, doubt the existence of all sorts of things. And it's not so much doubting that these things are there. I'm thinking more of sort of doubting that these things could exist in some kind of mind-independent way. So think of money as an example. It's a social construction. Okay, so it exists, but it exists because we've made it. And it's almost like a conspiracy in the sense that two or more people have come together, conspired to agree that there will be this thing called money, and that it's got some kind of value, so it's worth trading it for apples or whatever you're going to use the money for. So it seems that it's only got value, and there's only meaning to it that we give to it. And the worry is that, and I've heard philosophers and other people say this sort of thing, that perhaps everything's like that. Perhaps it's all just a conspiracy. Meaning is a conspiracy. You know, maybe we've agreed to come together and agree that there are things like tables and chairs. So there are some physicists and even some philosophers who tell you, well, it's actually just a collection of molecules, and you know, we are conceptually dividing the world up in a certain way, but you could have conceptually divided it in a completely different way. So even tables and chairs exist just because we've agreed that it's so. Perhaps the world is just some continuous manifold, like a porridge, and it could have been carved up in any number of ways, in which case you could doubt, in some sense, the mind-independent reality of things like tables and chairs. Perhaps there's no non-linguistic reality at all. And then the limits of my language really are the limits of my world, as someone once said, after spending time in a cabin in Norway. It's even been put to me that electrons didn't exist until 1897. from 1897, they did exist. And they'd always existed. But they didn't exist until 1897. When somebody put this to me, I was sceptical. I thought, well, that seems to violate the law of non-contradiction. But then I was told that the law of non-contradiction was itself something that we'd created. So I shouldn't take that too seriously either. It was all just a social construction, including the laws of logic. So the argument was there's no metaphysical reality at all apart from our beliefs about it. Is there anything that I couldn't doubt to be a social construction? It would be lovely if we could find some fundament on which to build some certainty, some knowledge about the world. These were all my thoughts that I ran through on the first day in the cabin. And I must admit I was left with some feeling of despondency at the end of the first day. Feeling there seemed nothing certain in the world at all. Everything could have just been made up by us. It didn't help that during the night I was kept awake by the sound of a whale that visited the fjord. But that's another story. It was freezing cold in the cabin. I said the stove was important. It was in the winter. Bakkan is a tiny village just outside Tromsø. It's on an island. And I visited during the winter, so it was 24 hours of darkness and going down to about minus 20. And we know that the cold can be very harsh. In fact, there's at least one philosopher who you could say was killed by the cold. But I was determined it wouldn't... that I wouldn't have the same fate. So I came to the second day. And fortunately, in the night when I was being kept awake by the whale, I remembered a conversation that I once had. So I've just finished a period as Dean of the Arts Faculty at Nottingham, and I'm very pleased to have come to the end of that time. But it meant that I got to... see some really interesting talks from other disciplines that I wouldn't usually have gone to. And I once went to a lecture in linguistics, and I was introduced to a gentleman who I was told was one of the top linguists in this country. He was a German gentleman, but working in the UK. And he said to me, "Oh, what do you do?" I said, "I'm a philosopher." Said, "What do you work on?" I said, "Causation." And he said, "Phew, I don't believe in causation." And I thought, well, how could you not believe in causation? He said, I think it's all a social construction. And he said, we just had a bunch of experiences, and we kind of constructed the notion of causation to make sense of the world. So I this was before the lecture. I then had to sit through this lecture on linguistics, but all the time I was worrying about this, because I thought, if he's right, my life's work so far has been all for nothing. I've been a fool, because I've been trying to develop a realist theory of causation, that it is something that exists independently of our own thinking. So it seemed a very serious challenge. But while I was there in that cabin, in Bakkan, just outside Tromsø, in the Arctic, I realised on the second morning that I could answer the objection. This was a great relief. And it seemed that the answer was absolutely certain. So here's what I thought. So this gentleman's claim was that causation was a social construction. So in the first place, society is said to construct something, to make it. And this, if the only way I can understand that claim is that it's a claim that society has caused something to be. It has brought something into existence. So it seemed to me that causation must be real for any claim of social constructivism to have force. So even if you're claiming that money is a social construction, then you need the reality of causation so that society is able to construct the idea of money. So I accept that there are many things that are socially constructed, like money, like language, perhaps things like gender. But for them to be so, they have to be constructed, they have to be made, they have to be caused to be. Construction requires causation. That's point number one. Point number two might be even more important. Because that which is constructed, the claim is, it's constructed by a society. So first of all, the claim was that causation was socially constructed. And I'm saying that commits the view to the reality of causation. But second, the claim is that it's socially constructed. Now, a society will be a plurality, but it has to be more than just a plurality. It absolutely, essentially has to be an interacting plurality. So to be part of a society isn't just to be one among many, it's to be one among many that interact, that change each other. It certainly would not count as a society if it was just merely an aggregate of discrete elements that did not interact, did not affect each other. So, unless there is causation, there's no society either. So, causation cannot be socially constructed. It is real. It exists. And this is not authentic Latin, but it seems we could sum up this argument by saying societas ergo causalitas. Causation is real. Now, some might claim that this is all just words. There are some deflationary views of metaphysics I've heard that say, well, it's nothing more than conceptual analysis. It can't actually tell you anything about the world or anything about what exists. It's just telling you about concepts. And so it might be alleged, even in this case, that cause is itself only a word, and I'm not doing anything other than conceptual analysis. But while I'm not a late Wittgensteinian, or even an early Wittgensteinian, I think there is some strength in Wittgenstein's private language argument. And this tells me that, well, there are many interpretations of the private language argument, but here's one message I'm taking from it. For there to be language and for there to be meaning, there has to be normativity that could not be provided without social interaction. So the reason a solitary thinker couldn't come up with a language, maybe you don't need me to talk you through the philosophical investigations, but that thinker wouldn't know whether they were using a word correctly or merely believing that they were using it correctly. So you need a plurality of language users so that you can challenge each other. And this gives us a normative aspect to language where there is correct meaning and incorrect meaning. So the message I'm taking from Wittgenstein is the idea that there could only be language if there was a plurality of causally interacting language users. So this allows me to introduce an additional step. So I've said if there is a society, there has to be causation, otherwise it wouldn't be a society. But the extra step now tells us that for there to be language, there has to be a society, and for there to be society, there has to be causation. I've got one further argumentative step. So, I'm one of those people who thinks that while there may be some non-conceptual mental content, such as if you see the colour red or something, there could be some things like that, or a feeling of pain. But most of my thinking is conceptual. Okay, so I'm able to think things about what will I do on Friday, and it's only because I have concepts at my disposal I'm able to have such a thought. And I think it's only because I'm a language user can I have such conceptual thought. Now, of course, there's lots being written on philosophy of mind, and there's lots of views on this. But I think that, well, my view is that most of what I think of as cognition is dependent on me being a language user. So there may be some that isn't. And I don't want to say that cats and dogs can't think just because they don't have a sophisticated language. Maybe it's something that comes in degrees. But certainly, I think that the cognition with which I'm acquainted in my own case is highly dependent on the fact that I'm a language user. So this extra step is now telling me that if there is cognition, there is language. Or if there is a high-level, sophisticated cognition of the kind that I think I have, not that I think I'm particularly special, the kind that any person has. If there is cognition, there is language. And if there is language, there is a society. And if there is society, there is causation. So it follows, if I put all those arguments together, that cogito ergo causalitas. There is thinking, therefore there is causation. Right. So, I was quite pleased with this discovery. Slept better on the second night. Although the whale did wake me up again. And nobody else in the village believed that the whale was there. They said I was imagining it, but well, we'll see. We'll see. Now, the nice thing about being a philosopher and having philosophical arguments is that they produce certainty. Whereas empirical arguments always have a degree of doubt. But I was made aware, after a conversation with another villager who was the village where I stayed back on, it's got four houses, and I got to know the people who lived in the other houses, and one of them was a scientist, specifically a biologist. And I'd had a conversation, and they said, oh, philosophy, you know, does it really tell you things about the world? And I explained that I'd come up with this argument, and it, you know, it showed with certainty something about the world, namely that causation was real. And they were still not convinced. They said, well, I've got friends and they're physicists, and they say, well, if you understand science properly, it tells you that there isn't really any causation, you know. they deal with equations, for instance, and they can be read left to right or right to left, and there's no proper asymmetry in the world. And so I was presented with a new challenge, that it's not really the right of philosophy to tell you how the world really is, because some of these things are empirical questions, and you should be a naturalist, and you should admit that science may discover that there is no real causation. Maybe everything reduces to fundamental physics, and in fundamental physics there's no real causation. Maybe cause is just a concept from folk science. You know, it's part of a way of understanding the world that goes back at least 2,000, 3,000 years. So why assume that once we have a sophisticated science that causation is going to be part of that? So if it is an empirical question, and if we do think that we should be naturalists, not naturists, naturalists, then, you know, we shouldn't feel we can be so certain about anything. We've got to leave it as an open question, an empirical question. Now, this disturbed me for a while, until I realised that science cannot possibly show us that there is no causation. So I don't need to worry what science tells us, even the most sophisticated physics. I don't need to know much science to know that there has to be causation. And this is because the very possibility of science rests on it. There would be no science unless there was causation. Here's a few reasons why I would think this. So, suppose we accept that physics often offers us equations. And in Russell's 1913 paper on the notion of cause, where he has scepticism about the existence of causation, one of his main reasons is because if you look at physics, you'll see just lots of equations and you won't see any asymmetries. Whereas causation is supposed to be asymmetric. The cause produces the effect rather than vice versa. And he says, look at physics and you don't find any of that. But I don't think that would be conclusive at all. Physics attempts to give us a mathematical representation of the world. And the fact that certain things are left out of that representation doesn't automatically mean that those things are not real. It may be that you're only interested in certain mathematical structures that apply to the world, but they don't necessarily describe everything about the world. So the omission of a direction of dependence that we think is there in causation isn't conclusive. What's more, I think there are many cases where we can describe something in an equation, but we do think that there is a clear direction of dependence, even if it's left out of the equation. So we could provide a formula that allows you from the height and location of a man and the position of the sun, that you can calculate the length of the shadow. But also, given the length of the shadow and the position of and height of the man, I can calculate the location of the sun. And that's just done mathematically by switching things around. Plus, of course, well, from any of those two variables, I can calculate the third. Does that mean there's no causation involved? Does it mean I could intervene on the shadow and change the position of the sun? No. But I think I could intervene on the height of the man. I could get him to stand on a box, for instance, and that would change the length of the shadow. That's not my main argument in this section. Here is the main argument. So I mentioned a notion of intervention there. We can intervene on one variable to change another, but I can't intervene on maybe the second variable to change the first. So I've invoked a notion of intervention there. And this is extremely important to science. Science often performs interventions. The whole idea of experiment is premised on the idea that we can intervene to change the world. Now, suppose a scientist says, well, I've got to learn a bit of physics, and I've seen, you know, there's just these equations, these variables, you know, covariation is most you get. And if you perform, say you perform a medical trial on, if you're an epidemiologist, what you may find is a correlation. And what they mean by correlation is that when this variable is high, that variable is high, but when this variable is low, the other variable is low. So that shows what you mean as a correlation. But an epidemiologist, I've spoken to epidemiologists, they say, we're trained not to make causal claims. We're never going to say that this variable is the cause of that variable. We're just going to observe that there's a correlation. So it seems, I'm having to rush because I know we haven't got all night. But I've spoken to epidemiologists who just say, our only concern is with the data. We'd never posit a causal connection. We'd never say that raising this variable will make the other variable change, because that's a kind of metaphysical claim. Their concern is with the data, not metaphysics. Okay, but then what about interventions? Can you really say that you are intervening in the world and changing it? If you're saying, well, it's just data, it's just this variable changes and that variable changes. No, the scientist is intervening. They are changing a variable because it produces a change in the other variable. Now, if any scientist wants to come to me and deny this, I'm going to say, unless you actually believe in the reality of causation and that your interventions and your experiments make a difference, why on earth should I give you any research funding? Okay, so I checked on Google. You know, CERN, underground in Geneva, they've got this Large Hadron Collider. They accelerate particles underground, this underground ring, and they smash particles into other particles. They say they found the Higgs boson this way. Now, I saw that their annual budget for 2015 was £767 million. Now, if there is no real causation, why do they need all that money? Of course, it could just be an expensive welfare system to give scientists something to do with their time. But no, I think it isn't. That would be insulting to suggest that. We're giving them all this money because they actually do accelerate particles. They actually can smash them into other particles. If I found, for instance, that, suppose I found somehow that Hume's constant conjunction account of causation was correct, I would immediately withdraw all scientific research funding because, you know, the world is never going to be more than one thing followed by another. It's never going to be more than conjunction without connection. So what the scientists actually did wouldn't make any difference. So why bother giving them £767 million a year for one experiment? Without causation, there's no intervention. And it's even worse than that. So, the premise of science is that we can observe the world. Data, it's about the data. Scientists acquire data empirically. So this requires observation of the world. This is a it shows us the metaphysical fundament upon which science rests. And this is the reality of causation, because there is no observation of the world without causation. To observe the world rather than merely to imagine something means that the world has changed me in some way. It's caused a perception within me. Similarly with measurement, which is also very important in science. So if I stick a voltmeter on my car battery and I see a hand move across a dial, I feel that's a measurement of the voltage of the battery. So there I've got some data. I've performed an observation. It counts as such only if something about the battery has caused that dial, or has caused the hand to move across the dial. Not every measurement is like this. If you put a ruler next to something, I think it's a fairly uninteresting causal connection. But many measurements depend upon there being some causal connection between a feature of the world and the measuring device. Consider a Geiger counter or an oscilloscope. They're only telling you something about the world if they're entering into a causal reaction with it. So any scientist who says, I'm only interested in the data, we should never go beyond the data, well, that's not good enough. That's only going to work if you have made a metaphysical assumption as to the reality of causation. That's fine. I'm happy to give that to the scientist. As long as they don't then come back and tell me that science is everything, you should be a naturalist, you can't do any a priori metaphysics, because science wouldn't even get off the ground without this assumption of the reality of causation. So it may be one thing to claim the reality of causation. I think there's still a very significant job to say exactly what it is. Many people have accepted the reality of causation, but I suspect that they've not always succeeded in getting to its essence, to the truth of it, what it's really like. Hume, for instance, was motivated by the thought that causation was imperceptible and that we had no choice but to think about it in terms of regularities or associations. And then he came up with this analysis that it was nothing more than constant conjunction, temporal priority and contiguity. Many Humeans, and I'd say probably Hume himself, will often claim that they do accept the reality of causation. They do accept causal powers and so on. But then they will say what they mean by a causal power, or what they mean by a cause, can't be anything more than constant conjunction, temporal priority and contiguity. But this is causation, they'd say. Well, no, I think we can say no to them. So if causation really was nothing more than that, then I'd say that doesn't give us any society. All it would mean is that one member of society's actions were constantly conjoined at best with somebody else's actions, but there's no actual causal production. So there's nothing really that would bind that plurality together as a society. What I think is really going on here is that I think Humeans think that they're giving a reductive account of causation, whereas my interpretation of it would be that it's basically an eliminativist view of causation, because they're saying that something we think is part of causation isn't really there. And if it's something that's essential to causation, a notion of production over and above regularity, they're saying that's not really there. So I think it is an elimination of causation, as much as Humeans protest. Similarly, we of course, there's a very popular view of causation that it consists in nothing more than counterfactual dependence. Now, I haven't got the time tonight to go into all the details as to why I think a counterfactual dependence view of causation is inadequate. But what I would say is that things like regularity, counterfactual dependence, maybe even probability raising, these could be symptoms of causal production, but without being causation itself. Real causes will tend to make a difference, and that's where the difference-making conception of causation comes from. But they don't all make a difference. Say in the case of overdetermination, or so there are some difference makers that are not causes. But I'm going to take that as a symptom of causation. Similarly, regularity might be a symptom of causation, but it's not constitutive of it. A cause should be understood as singularly tending towards its effect, and on occasions producing it. But there's this notion of production, which I think is essential to the notion of cause, which is lacking from the Humean account. In fact, it's lacking from all reductive accounts. So what I'm offering you is not a reductive analysis of causation. I think we've just got to accept its reality and that it's fundamental and irreducible. I've given you some reasons why it's fundamental. See, sometimes in philosophy, people notice a notion resists analysis for a while, and they think, okay, let's just take it as a primitive. And I think that sometimes can be an easy way out. But I think in the case of causation, it does sound like the sort of thing that really should be a primitive. It does sound like one of the most fundamental things in the world. And I think I can go on to give you some more reasons for saying that. So you might say, okay, so you've proven the reality of causation. I'm convinced, you might say. Thank you for coming and explaining this to us. It's absolutely persuasive. But what about tables and chairs? You know, what about everything else? Can we really use causation as a bedrock and build things on top of that? Well, I think it can't do any harm, because we could think, well, what are these things? What are tables and chairs? What are properties? What is redness? What is squareness, sphericity? What are all these other things that seem to populate the world? Well, we could, now that we're armed with a realist view about causation, we could think of things as bundles of causal powers. You could think of matter itself as power. You could think that to be is to be causally powerful, and all these other things like tables and chairs and properties of squareness and redness, we know about them through their effects on us. We know about them because they are causally powerful. We know about these things ultimately because of their effects on us. It's arguable that causation is what holds things together. Without it, our world would be unfathomable. So if we didn't have things causally connected to each other, suppose the world was just one thing followed by another, there would be no guarantee that when we made an intervention that something else would follow from it. Now, the world isn't entirely dependable. It still sometimes surprises us. Sometimes when I strike a match, it doesn't light. But the world does have a degree of reliability. I know that striking matches is the best way of getting them to light. I know that matches that are struck tend to light, as opposed to they don't tend to evaporate or combust. Oh no, they do combust. They don't turn into a chicken or any other possible thing. And because the world has a degree of regularity, it makes it comprehensible. It allows us to form scientific laws that summarise the working of the world. Causation really does seem to provide for us. Without causation, we wouldn't be able to grow food. So we wouldn't be physically sustained. Maybe without causation, our bodies would just fall apart. So causation provides for our bodies. It also provides for our minds by giving it contents and giving us a world that's comprehensible. It makes me feel very grateful that I live in a world in which there is causation. And another thing. So this is what I came to at the end of my fifth day. It seems that God could not have created anything without causation. God couldn't have created causation because he would have needed causation to exist in order to have done so. Create is a causal notion, as we saw when we looked at the social construction issue. So there must be causation for God to create anything. It follows that he cannot create causation itself. But I'm also told that God is supposed to be the first thing. So how could God be the first thing if causation would have already had to exist in order for God to have performed any action? Well, given that issue and that causation gives us existence, it gives us a comprehensible world, it seems to sustain us, isn't the right conclusion that God is identical with causation? And then God can be the self-causing cause. God can be the first cause. God can be the first mover. So this bears a passing resemblance to Aquinas' second way. God as the uncaused cause. Well, I don't know how seriously to take that argument, but maybe you could moderate the claim a bit, although still a pretty strong claim. But a more moderate version of it would be, nothing in the world would deserve the name of God more than causation. Because causation is what sustains us, it makes things happen. Perhaps causation is what we pray to. So when you're watching the lottery draw and you're praying for your six balls to come up, aren't you actually just praying that the causes work out in your favour? That's what you're praying to. Okay, so I haven't really answered the question of how do we know anything else exists. Well, I'll be brief here. There are many other sort of general categories of things, properties, particulars, events, processes, and so on. But given what I've said above, it seems there is some hope that now that we have proven the real existence of causation, we can then construct those other categories of things from causation, from our starting point. We could say, for instance, that causes manifest themselves in processes. So that's what a process is. And a process is an extended event. So an event is actually just going to be the manifesting of a cause. And that these things then, these causal powers can constitute properties and substances and matter. Now, my official view is that causation may be only a necessary condition for all of these things. But I have known some people who tried to push it further and say that causation is a sufficient condition for these things. So I had a PhD student a few years ago was aiming for a one category ontology. If you've got causal powers, you could take properties as clusters of causal powers, and then you could take particulars as clusters of properties. I'm a bit nervous about making that final step. But I could still see by the Eliatic reality test that particulars need to be causally powerful, even if they're not exhausted by their causal powers. By the end of the sixth day, which I started with all these doubts, maybe, you know, I can't be sure that anything really exists, I felt I was able to emerge from the cabin having proven the existence of everything, or at least removed sufficient doubt from the existence of most things based on this fundamental bedrock of causation. But there's one interesting thing to note about this. The correct starting point for these meditations was not self-consciousness, and it wasn't my individual experience. So it's not the old cogito argument. It's not introspection at all. In fact, the new argument that I've offered works backwards from the existence of something outside of myself back to the existence of thought, cognition. And it did make me wonder, if you go for this view and if you think that meaning, cognition, these are all dependent on us being part of an interacting plurality, then it makes you wonder whether meditation itself is bad for philosophy, or any philosophy that begins from the individual subjective experience. What we need is more causal interaction. We need more of a dialogue than a meditation. So when I finally left the village of Bakan, I did resolve to never again indulge in lonely meditation in case it were to lead me astray, but instead to spread the good news. Causation is real, exists. We should rejoice. We should celebrate the existence of causation. Is it any wonder that people gather in churches and mosques and synagogues to praise and give thanks to causation for having provided them with so much?